Today I'm going to talk about some recent developments in the theory of quark matter at high density. The two main topics I'm going to emphasize are color superconductivity and some special properties of the Fermi surface that really underlie a lot of the theoretical control we have over the system. There was actually a workshop here at ITP all through the spring on this subject. For the local people, you may have heard some of this before, but the emphasis I'm going to place on the properties of the Fermi surface might be something that you haven't heard before. Here I have a very sort of simplified diagram of the QCD phase diagram. The vertical axis here is temperature. The horizontal axis could either be thought of as baryon chemical potential or baryon density. There are sort of three qualitatively different phases here. We live here, of course. If I go to finite density, but not really high density, I'll be in a sort of nuclear matter phase. If I increase the density enough, the effective degrees of freedom will sort of switch from being color singlet nuclear states into states or degrees of freedom which have roughly the quantum numbers of quarks. A lot has been learned about this part of the phase diagram just in the last few years. I really won't say very much about temperature. I just include the temperature axis because that's actually where the results are in some sense the strongest because we can do lattice simulations. Along this axis, if you set mu equals zero, if you set the baryon density to zero, you can of course do very sophisticated lattice simulations. You can study the properties of this phase boundary, for example. For technical reasons that I will actually discuss, you can't do lattice today, at least today, you can't do lattice simulations of the rest of this diagram. So it was a kind of very big mystery what was going on in regions where, for example, mu was much larger than T until fairly recently. And for people in the audience who aren't particle physicists, let me just remind you that QCD is the theory of quarks and gluons. The degrees of freedom are the individual quarks, the gluons. Here I've actually displayed explicitly the chemical potential term, which sort of biases the energy of quarks and versus anti-quarks and creates a Fermi C. In the analysis that I'm going to do today, there are sort of three qualitatively different regions in density that you want to keep in mind. One is low density. So there, of course, things are strongly coupled. We have the familiar properties of confinement and chiral symmetry breaking. At a slightly higher density, but to the right of this boundary between nuclear matter and the density where you should think in terms of quark degrees of freedom, there's a region we call intermediate density where the coupling constant might still be strong, but the effective degrees of freedom are quarks. And one of the interesting things is that although this is a strongly coupled region, there's fairly good evidence that the ground state of this phase, of this region, is actually a color superconductor. And the third region is that of high density, and that's sort of defined by, roughly speaking, by the coupling constant evaluated at the scale mu is much less than one. And there we have very, very good theoretical control over the theory. We've calculated analytically things like the size of the color superconducting gap, what the true ground state of the theory is a function of the number of light quark flavors. So the results are quite strong. Oh, and I should just comment. The reason this figure is so simple, so if you've heard other talks on the subject, you'll see that I'm leaving out a lot of detail. For example, the order of the phase boundary here. Perhaps there are actually multiple sub-phases of color superconductivity. Most of those things are not on firm theoretical footing. So they might, you know, those other phases may exist, they might not. In this talk, I'm going to concentrate only on relatively rigorous results, results that are really the result of some kind of controlled approximation. And so rather than get into all the ephemera of what, you know, whether the strange quark mass should be regarded as heavy or light, whether we really have two light flavors or three light flavors, I'm going to concentrate on other aspects of the theory. Okay. Now, I use the term quark matter in this talk, and of course, it's not really very well defined. Roughly speaking, by quark matter, what I will mean is just matter at some density where the effective degrees of freedom really have the quantum numbers of quarks. So they're in the fundamental representation of SU3, rather than the low energy phase in, or low density phase, in which you should really think in terms of color singlet, baryons, pions, things like that. Now, you might expect that at very high density, due to asymptotic freedom, things simplify, and so maybe it's not surprising that you could get some very strong results. For people who aren't particle physicists, I'll just remind you that asymptotic freedom means that when you look at scattering processes where the momentum transfer is large or the effective distance scale is very short, you have a weakly coupled theory. However, there's a fundamental scale in the theory, which is about a Fermi, at which the interactions get very strong. And so at short distances, generally, you have better control over this theory. Now, due to Pauli exclusion, because quarks are fermions, when you force the system to have a net amount of baryon number, you must have a filled Fermi sea and therefore a Fermi surface. And there's a kind of folk theorem, I guess from condensed matter physics, which says that near a Fermi surface, arbitrarily weak interactions can cause Cooper pairing. And for me, when I first got interested in this particular subfield, this was kind of one of the things that I really wanted to understand better, because what re-triggered interest in this topic just a few years ago were some sort of model calculations in which people posited some set of dynamics for the intermediate density regime, and they sort of concluded, well, it's quite likely we could have color superconductivity and it's a novel phenomena. But of course, those are just model calculations, and so the question is there some stronger underlying reason why you would really expect to see color superconductivity in the system? And that sort of drew me to this folk theorem, and I wanted to understand that better. So something I'm going to spend a little bit of time on in this talk. Now, in the weakly coupled region, if you just look at one gluon exchange, which is a leading interaction term between two quarks, there's a channel, a color channel, the 3-bar channel, which is attractive. So unlike a normal superconductor, where you have to look at sort of high-order phonon effects in order to find an attractive channel, in this system, there is right away an attractive channel. And so you might guess from the beginning that color superconductivity or Cooper pairing is likely to occur in the system. And in fact, Stephen Frauchi at Caltech, as early as 1978, actually conjectured that that was the case. So he actually briefly explored this, and there's sort of a short flurry of activity around this time on this topic. I think he had a graduate student named Barwa who actually wrote a dissertation on it. And so, so the color quantum number is that it will turn out the pairing is in the 3-bar channel, the color 3-bar channel. However, so for spin and angular momentum, it turns out the dominant channel is S equals 0 and J equals 0. So it's a spinless color condensate. The color and flavor structure is somewhat complicated. I'm going to go into that in some detail. Okay. Now, if I just have a single condensate in the 3-bar channel, so that would be like a Higgs mechanism in which the Higgs degree of freedom is a 3-bar, what you would get is that's sort of like a vector pointing in the SU3 space. It breaks SU3 color to SU2. It leaves you with, so it Higgses five of the gluons, and it leaves three of the gluons massless. And of course, you have all kinds of standard effects like the Meissner effect, but in this case, a color Meissner effect. And that was all pretty much known in the late 70s, early 80s. Now, the modern developments are really controlled good calculations of what actually happens at asymptotic densities. It turns out the main technical issue here is what to do about long-range color fluctuations, and I'll say something about that today. Related to this last question was elaboration of the flavor structure. So it wasn't realized until recently that there's a very interesting phase called the color flavor lock phase, in which there's a very strong interplay between the flavor and color structure of the condensate. And it's now known that you can prove rigorously that in the three flavor case, so if you have three massless quark flavors, the color flavor locked ground state phase is state is the ground state, is a true ground state, has the lowest energy. And the third thing is that there are all kinds of nice techniques now for dealing with Fermi surface degrees of freedom, and also renormalization group methods, which I'll discuss. So let me just start by reviewing a little bit about physics near a Fermi surface. So I mentioned there was this kind of folk theorem that's been around for a long time, and it actually has it has someone's name attached to it. I can't remember what the name of it is. Somebody here probably remembers. But if I have a Fermi surface, so here the blue shaded regions are filled states, and so and those little dots, for example, are little quasi-particle excitations. It turns out that even an arbitrarily weakly attractive force can lead to pairing, Cooper pairing. And by Cooper pairing, I mean that the pairing occurs between quasi-particle states which are on opposite sides of the Fermi surface. So they have almost equal and opposite momenta. And that's called Cooper pairing. And there's a very simple way of understanding this. And you can understand it in terms of dimensional reduction. If you look at this Fermi surface, the dispersion relation for a quasi-particle at leading order, if you're very close to the Fermi surface, is that the energy is just equal to or proportional to the distance, the perpendicular distance in momentum space that you are from the Fermi surface. And so there's a symmetry here because there's a massive degeneracy because the energy of a state doesn't depend on the angular orientation of where you are on the surface, but just how far you are from the surface. And so you might expect that this Cooper pairing system has some effectively two-dimensional properties, and that's sort of indeed the case. So the simplest thing you might do is you might just posit some local four-fermion interaction or four-quark interaction and solve the Schwinger-Dyson or the gap equation for the gap function. And if you do that, you get a very nice, something very nice happens, which is that the integral which appears in this loop actually reduces to something which is effectively two-dimensional. It's logarithmically divergent, and that divergence is actually cut off by the gap itself, by the fact that this is actually a resum propagator. And so what you find is that when you simplify this equation, you find that if you sort of very roughly divide out delta on both sides, you get an equation which looks like 1 equals coupling constant times a logarithmic divergence in delta. So when you solve for delta, you find that the gap size is exponentially small in the coupling, which you sort of expect. However, it's non-zero regardless of how small you make the coupling. So even if you make the coupling infinitesimally small, you still can reduce the energy of the system slightly by forming a gap. It's just that the gap and the corresponding reduction in energy is very small. And so that's sort of one way of understanding this folk theorem. Now there's another way of understanding this folk theorem which I like a little bit better, and it's a renormalization group method. And there's kind of a long history for this. There are these two Italian mathematical physicists, Benfatto and Galavati, and they tried to really formalize the coarse graining process near a Fermi surface. And their goal was to kind of take a very specific set of model Hamiltonians and show that they exhibit superfluidity or superconductivity by actually rigorously finding the ground state. And Shunker actually elaborated on their techniques in a very nice review article, and Polchinski actually gave some lectures on this at TASI a few years ago. So it's a very nice example of effective field theory. The basic idea is that if you try to define an effective theory which only is meant to describe modes, excitations very close to this Fermi surface, and you make the thickness of this little shell in which your theory lives, as you make that thickness smaller and smaller, something very nice happens, which is that other than the kinetic energy term, all of the other operators except the Cooper pairing operator can be shown to be irrelevant operators. In other words, as you scale lambda to zero, those operators become smaller and smaller and their effect becomes smaller and smaller. So you can imagine a kind of renormalization group scaling where I take lambda to zero. If I do that, I scale the energy down by some parameter s, which is less than one. I scale the residual L, which is the momentum away from the Fermi surface, down by S. The Fermi momentum itself, of course, doesn't scale. And what you can show is that something special happens if the kinematics of a scattering process are such that P1 equals minus P2. And the way to think about that, without actually going through all the scaling arguments, is just that if I have two particles coming in and they have exactly equal and opposite momentum, then their net momentum is zero. And so they can rescatter out at any angle. Whereas if they don't come in with exactly equal and opposite momentum, there's a very restricted phase space that they can scatter into. And you know, for a particle physicist like me to learn about this subject, it had to be stated in some kind of with some very nice machinery like this. But I think if you go back and you look at the work by Landau, it's obvious that, you know, all these things were pretty well understood by those guys. They just didn't have a fancy way of and nice machinery for describing it. Now, so you're left with a very simple theory where you have a kinetic term and you have a Cooper pairing interaction, and everything else is irrelevant. The Cooper pairing interaction is marginal, so you actually have to look at the quantum corrections to see what it does. And so for our simple model, where I just have a contact interaction for fermion interaction, it's very simple to calculate the effect of the quantum corrections. You get an RG equation, and the RG equation exhibits a Landau pole. So if the attraction is if the interaction is attractive as you thin out the Fermi surface, or as you thin out your shell near the Fermi surface, this coupling actually blows up. The position of the Landau pole is actually exactly where the solution of the gap equation on the previous, or two slides ago, was. So it of course agrees. And so in the modern language, you'd say, if I have a Fermi surface, the existence of Cooper pairing is natural. That you would have to sort of work hard to avoid it. And we'll see that in the QCD case, this is true as well. Okay. So let me say a few words about, let me discuss the case of asymptotic density a little bit. Now, at asymptotic density, because of asymptotic freedom, you expect that the quarks are weakly coupled. You might expect that because the typical distance between the quarks is very small and the typical interaction involves large momentum transfer, that there's some controlled way of approximating the whole Cooper pairing dynamics in this limit. There's one technical complication, and it has to do with the magnetic mass of the gluon. So if I take a chunk of quark matter, and let's suppose I could generate a chromomagnetic field, just a static chromomagnetic field, and push it through that material. Because the quark matter doesn't have any degrees of freedom which carry magnetic charges, they only carry electric charges. Quarks carry electric charges, but there are no color monopoles. It's very difficult to screen that chromomagnetic field. And the way the corresponding statement is that if you calculate the effect of the medium on the propagation of a gluon, you find right away a screening mass for the electric degrees of freedom, which is called the Debye term, but you don't generally find a screening mass for the magnetic degrees of freedom. And so that's a problem, because when you actually look at the gap equation in the case where you don't have a contact term, but you literally have to exchange a gluon in order to get the interaction, there's actually a divergence where this gluon, the magnetic part of the gluon, goes on shell, and this equation blows up. So you need to understand how that singularity is regularized. And so that took a while, and so that was really the main barrier why in 1978, when those guys worked on it, they got basically wrong answers, because they didn't really know how to solve this problem. And the guy who really pointed out how this is solved is Sohn. He really, because he's trained in the Soviet system, he had very good mastery of some of these things. And the thing that he really had mastery of is something called Landau damping. He understood what Landau damping was. Landau damping is a process where a gluon, a magnetic gluon, can lose energy to quasi-particle degrees of freedom. And so if I resum the effects of Landau damping in the gluon propagator, I get a screening term, which is not a mass term, it's actually an imaginary term, and it really reflects the rate at which a gluon can lose energy. But if the gluon is absolutely static, if it doesn't have any energy, then it can't lose any energy, and there's no screening of that, an absolutely static magnetic gluon. However, this term, when added into the Stringer-Dyson process or into the renormalization group process, is enough to control the singularities that come from nearly on-shell magnetic gluons. So that was just worked out a couple of years ago, and quite a lot of people worked on this. It actually defines a new momentum scale. It turns out the dominant scale inside of this gap equation is determined by the extent to which the magnetic degree of freedom can get on shell. And so basically it's at some special momentum Q, which is of order G of Q, where G is a Landau damping term. And so it defines a special scale, which is sort of a kind of geometric mean, not quite a mean, but a geometric, geometrically in between the Debye screening term, the Debye screening mass MD, and the scale of the gap delta. And when you work this all out, and it's probably not too appropriate to really work it out in detail in a colloquium, you get a very nice result. The surprising thing is that the gap, although it's exponentially small in the coupling, it's exponentially small in 1 over g, not 1 over alpha. And so that was quite a surprise. People thought it was going to be 1 over alpha, but it's actually 1 over g. So it's actually bigger than you expect. There's an easy way to understand that, which I'll explain in 1 second. The other thing is that the expansion turns out to be a systematic expansion, not in powers of alpha s, but in powers of gs. So it's also not as well controlled as you would have hoped. The reason you get an extra, or the reason you get e to the minus 1 over g instead of e to the minus 1 over g squared is because this integral is doubly logarithmic divergence. There's the original logarithmic divergence, which came from the dimensional reduction. There's another log divergence that comes from this gluon being almost on shell, and which is regularized by Landau damping. So you get an equation in which 1 equals alpha s times log delta quantity squared. And so when you solve for delta, you're going to get something which goes like 1 power of g, not 2 powers of g.
Where is that logarithmic divergence in the self-energy of the quarks that destroys the whole description in terms of weakly interacting?
There isn't a logarithmic divergence in the self-energy of the gluon.
What is the imaginary part of self-energy?
Oh, this right here?
No, that's for the quark. That's for the
gluon.
Yeah.
Well, this is a very small effect. So you get pairing, but this is, you know, in the weak coupling regime, this is quite a small quantity. Now you can study what happens if I include higher order effects here, and what you can show is that the higher order effects lead to corrections of this result, which are down by powers of g. So really, the correct statement is that if g strong at q star, which is this intermediate scale, is much less than 1, then you have a controlled expansion. I don't know if I answered your question. You shook your head, but I mean, the way you would check this self-consistently is that you would look at additional corrections to the process that you've considered, and you can show that the additional corrections are down by powers of g.
I was wondering about the self-energy, knowing the anomalous quark propagator, the regular diagonal quark propagator.
Oh, you mean just a You mean just the propagation of a single quark in this medium? Well, once I renormalize a theory, then that correction is down by an actual power of alpha s. So
maybe with a log divergence.
If I renormalize it properly, there should be no log divergence. I mean, after renormalization, everything should be finite. And I'm not. I mean, of course, my subtraction point should be at some scale, which is roughly this q star, which is why alpha s of q star appears in all these things. Okay, so the takeaway from this is that at asymptotic densities you have some very precise results. You can go even further. You can actually determine the ground state energy, for example, or the ground state wave functional for the system. Now, the Schwinger, if you're sort of an expert, you know that neither the renormalization group analysis nor the Schwinger-Dyson or gap equation analysis is really sufficient to determine the ground state of the system, because the RG analysis just identifies some instability that you encounter as you coarse grain down. The Schwinger-Dyson equation just identifies extrema of the energy of the system, doesn't actually tell you the ground state. And in fact, it turns out there are many, in more complicated cases of many flavors, there are lots of solutions to the Schwinger-Dyson equations which have different structure. And you actually have to compare them and see which one has the lowest energy. Okay, and you actually have to calculate a bunch of bubble graphs. There is a general argument that the binding energy goes like the surface area of the Fermi surface times delta squared, where delta is the gap energy. So you're talking about energies of that scale. Now, from a kind of pretty basic analysis, you know that the attractive channel is a 3-bar of color, and that's an anti-symmetric channel. From an analysis that I haven't shown you yet, you know that actually this is the most attractive channel, J equals L equals S equals 0. So that's also anti-symmetric. By the Pauli principle, then, you know that in the flavor indices also, whatever condensate you produce also has to be anti-symmetric. So in the two-flavor case, where the only two quarks are up and down, you get something which is an isospin singlet, UD minus DU. In the case of three flavors, though, it's more complicated because there are many ways to make a three bar of SU3 out of two quarks. You could have UD minus DU, you could have US minus SD, or SD minus DS. So there are actually three of these guys. And so in the three flavor case, we're actually led to something interesting, which is called color flavor locking, and that was that term was coined by Alfred Rajagopal and Wilczek. And I'll give you my simple way of understanding color flavor locking. So this formula summarizes what I was just saying about the symmetry, or rather anti-symmetry properties of a condensate. It's got to be anti-symmetric in the color indices and a 3. It's got to be anti-symmetric and a 3 in the flavor indices. And then there's some arbitrary matrix, which can sit here. And the matrix is funny because the matrix has one color index and one flavor index. And what Wilczek and company realize is that actually this matrix might do something funny and actually couple the orientation of the condensate in the color direction to its orientation in the flavor space. And in fact, that's the color flavor lock phase. So it turns out that by using some residual global symmetries, you can show that A, this matrix A, has to have the form a diagonal matrix with three entries A, B, and C. It turns out when you put this into the Schringer-Dyson equation, it forces A, B, and C to be, in a sense, one. I mean, it fixes the norm of the size of A, B, and C. But that still leaves you with a number of possible different vacua. CFL is a case in which so here I have a little blob which is supposed to represent the condensate. I've labeled which flavors of quarks are participating down here, and I've just sort of indicated in some sense what direction and color space that condensate points. The color flavor lock phase is one in which each flavor channel points in an orthogonal color channel from the others. And so I label that by 1, 1, 1. You get that by taking A equals 1, B equals 1, C equals 1. There are other possibilities, and the other possibilities also solve the Schringer-Dyson equations. So for example, you could have a condensate in which B and C are 0, or one of them is 0. I call this 1, 0, 0, 1, 1, 0. When you solve the Schringer-Dyson equations, you actually find that the gaps are larger in the non-color flavor locked phases. However, when you actually go and calculate the energies, you find that the color flavor lock phase actually has the lowest energy. And so that is the true ground state of three flavor quark matter at high density. And I won't show you the details of the calculation, but it's quite tedious. It actually involves some numerical work. And the nice thing is that some very recent results allow you to reproduce this result, that the color flavor locked phase is the true ground state, basically analytically, using something called the Vafa-Witten inequalities. So if I have time, I'll cover that at the very end.
It seems to be rather natural. Your conclusion was that ground state energy is proportional to delta Q. So usually larger delta if you larger communication energy.
Correct.
And here it just doesn't run off. Why is that?
It's because in these cases, although the gap itself is larger, there are more particles which are gapped in this case. Because some of them don't, in these other phases, some of the quarks are not gapped. So it's bigger gap, but fewer gapped particles.
Is this sensitive to the mass of the strange quark?
Yeah, here I'm taking the strange quark to be zero, or at least negligible compared to mu.
So you could change this conclusion.
Absolutely. So when I said I showed you a very simplified phase diagram, what I meant by that is I didn't try to guess whether we're in the two-flavor case or the three-flavor case. And there's a whole bunch of interplay between the mass of the strange quark and other things.
Effectively, when the quark mass, strange quark mass becomes larger.
Yeah, you'll go back to the two-flavor case, and in which case then you have an isosinglet pairing.
Well, then there's no way to lock, so it's color is three.
Right, you only have one pairing.
Okay,
so that's a summary of the results in the weak coupling regime. Yeah. It is. It is analogous. In this case, it's flavor color instead of orbital. Yeah. I think actually, you can ask Frank about this, but I think he knew, like, he's well educated, unlike me. So he knew about that phase, and that inspired this discovery. So, okay. Let me say a few words about intermediate density. So far, I've focused on a regime in which the effective coupling is small. And of course, that's not really the regime that we are most interested in, because it's most likely that So where are we likely to find the system in nature? Well, probably most likely at the core of a neutron star. However, and there's a big mystery about what the equation of state of nuclear matter is at high density, so we don't really know exactly what the maximum core density of a neutron star is, but it's probably not likely to be large enough that QCD is perturbative at the core. It's probably likely that even if we're lucky enough to have quark matter in the core, it's probably quark matter in which alpha S is of order 1. So we try to, really the important regime to study is the intermediate density regime. Now, we're helped a little bit in this study because we sort of have two parameters. You might just think the only small parameter we might have is alpha S, but we could also have another small parameter, which is the gap size, which is, you know, where the pairing is relative to the Fermi surface, the thickness of that region, divided by the radius of the Fermi surface, mu. And it turns out, self-consistently, when you study all this stuff, you generally can get gaps which are quite large, 50 to 100 MeV, but mu itself might be as large as, say, 500 MeV. So this is potentially a small parameter as well in the discussion. So what you can do is you can study the intermediate density case using the renormalization group approach, and a couple groups did that. Now, in order to make progress, there's a fairly reasonable conjecture you can make, which is that in this strongly coupled regime, there may be some fluctuations or degrees of freedom which sort of act like things with intrinsic magnetic charge. And on the lattice, there's quite a whole industry of people looking in the QCD vacuum and finding what are called color magnetic monopoles, or effective degrees of freedom which act like color monopoles. If there are such degrees of freedom around, and I think it's quite likely, then it's probably fair to actually use a local operator rather than a non-local operator. In other words, the magnetic gluons themselves are actually probably not able to propagate long distances in the strongly coupled region. So if you make that assumption, and for example, another set of models that have these local interactions are sort of instanton inspired models that people use in nuclear physics. But let's just suppose that I look at the most general set of marginal local operators near the Fermi surface. You can sort of classify how that system can behave given fairly arbitrary matching conditions. So what you find is that if you study, and it's quite a large set of operators, but you can study the RG flow of that set of operators, and generically you do find color superconductivity. The only way to really avoid color superconductivity is to sort of stand on your head and insist that when you match this effective theory back to QCD, that a bunch of couplings which you normally would expect to be attractive are actually large and repulsive. And that's the only way to avoid color superconductivity. So I would say, to me, this is the best argument that if neutron stars have quark matter in them, that quark matter will be color superconducting. There are other arguments you could give, which is I'll make up some model for how this region should interact, but I don't really think we know what the interactions are, so you should just study the most general possible set. And as I said, it's sort of self-consistent because the gap sizes you get, while very large, much larger than you might have expected or hoped for, this is really kind of very large hadronic kind of scale. It's still small relative to the mu's that you're talking about, and so delta over mu is actually small. Okay. Now, I'd like to elaborate a little bit more about an effective theory of the quasiparticles near the Fermi surface. And it turns out that you can learn even more by looking very carefully about what a theory of small fluctuations around the Fermi surface has to look like. And this point of view is very much inspired by, although on the surface you might wonder why, it's actually inspired by heavy quark effective theory. And the reason is that if you think of an excitation which just has a little bit of residual momentum L and a large component of momentum of which has magnitude mu, you can think of that sort of like a heavy quark, in the sense that in heavy quark effective theory, if you have a B quark or a C quark, the brown muck, or the low energy gluonic degrees of freedom, can barely deflect that B or C quark because the mass is so heavy. In this case, what you have is particles which have a very large component of momentum mu. It's not really seen in the dynamics because the energy is proportional to L. It's not proportional to the length of this whole vector, but just the residual part. But if I'm mainly interested in low energy degrees of freedom, i.e. the non-perturbative gluons, which generally give me trouble, Those guys are unable to deflect this large vector in the limit where mu is large compared to lambda QCD. So you might expect that this effective theory of quasiparticles simplifies a lot if I'm willing to let mu be large compared to lambda QCD. And so we can study that. And the property that we're going to get out of all this is that the leading description of these small fluctuations, the Euclidean version of that leading theory, has a positive path integral measure. And that sounds like a very technical thing, but the real obstacle to simulating systems of fermions at finite density on the lattice is that the fermion determinant, or the path integral measure, is complex, and so you can't actually use Monte Carlo. You can't use important sampling to do the integrals. But in the Euclidean version of the leading part of this theory, you actually can use important sampling. So let me just remind you what happens to dense QCD in Euclidean space. So I take these Euclidean gamma matrices, which are Hermitian, and the anti-commutation relation is delta mu nu rather than g mu nu. The operator whose determinant I have to take in order to do this lattice simulation is a combination of the covariant derivative and then plus this chemical potential term. And the problem is that this operator is, gammas are Hermitian, d is anti-Hermitian, but mu is a number, so it's Hermitian. And so you end up with an operator which is neither Hermitian nor anti-Hermitian. And so in general, the eigenvalues are complex. If I set mu to 0, then I end up with a purely anti-Hermitian operator, so the eigenvalues are complex, but it turns out through some magic with gamma 5, you can show that they come in pairs, and so the net determinant can be taken to be positive. And that's it's this property that actually lets you do lattice simulations at 0 mu. Because in general, if you just take some fermionic system, you might end up with a complex determinant, like a chiral gauge theory. Okay. So we sort of have a problem, though, clearly, if I want to have mu non-zero, because this thing doesn't look like it's going to have a positive determinant. Okay, so this slide is a little dense for a colloquium, so I apologize. But how do you break the field apart into pieces which live just near the Fermi surface and other ones which are kind of irrelevant to those low energy dynamics? Well, here as a first step, what you might do is you might say, well, in this quark field, there are both quarks and anti-quarks, and certainly I don't need anti-quarks because the amount of energy I have to put into the system to excite an anti-quark is quite large. I have to get it out of the Dirac sea, and I have to bring it all the way up above the Fermi sea. So I have to pay at least the price of mu. So certainly, whatever description I'm using, I better just forget about the anti-quarks. I don't need them. Now, surprisingly, up until this time, when Hong first formulated this effective theory in analogy with heavy quark effective theory, people like me and everybody else in the field who had been doing calculations to get all these 1 over g's and things like that had actually been carrying around the anti-quarks in all of our equations, because they were totally irrelevant to what we were calculating, but they were just in there because we were too lazy to try to have done this formal exercise. So how do you integrate out the anti-quarks? Well, you just put in a projector which projects out alpha is gamma 0, gamma 5, gamma 0, gamma vector, which projects out the antiparticle modes. You can break psi up into a particle field and an antiparticle field. And then when you put in the mu gamma 5, you can see that the diagonal kinetic term for the antiparticle guys gets a big constant term, which suppresses them. So you can actually do this formal integrating out, and you end up with a leading term, which has a very, very simple form. And then you have higher order terms, which are suppressed by powers of mu. If you repeat this process in a more general way.
So you kind of, the kinetic energy has both a Dirac-like term and a Schrödinger-like term. Is that right?
Hmm. I'm not sure what you're pointing at.
In equation 9.
Yeah.
A Schrödinger-like term and the Dirac term. The first term is like a Dirac.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call this a Schrödinger term, but this is certainly a Dirac-like term.
Yeah, it's like a P squared term.
This term is actually really just, it's very simple because I told you that the dispersion relation for these particles should just be determined by the perpendicular distance from the Fermi surface.
Right.
And if you then say, well, how do I gauge covariantize that, you get this.
Right.
Okay. This other stuff is all higher dimension stuff, which you can neglect if the dynamics say the soft gluons are at some energy scale which is small compared to mu, and then these guys are suppressed.
Right.
So you're left with this guy. So if you formalize this, you can...
So condensed matter physicists, you know...
Have always been forgetting... They never cared about this.
But if they start... I mean, you know, didn't people know that they didn't include the positron when they calculated the conductivity?
Oh, definitely not. Yeah, they never... They were not so stupid. Yeah.
You just throw it above
that. You would just have this problem.
Yeah.
You would have the same positron.
Yeah.
No positron.
That's right. But the nice thing about all this is what this operator that you're left with, you can show actually has a positive determinant. Okay, so you can rewrite it in a kind of fancy way with these operators, e to the ix. X is a Hermitian operator, which actually just removes the large component of momentum.
So that's a little bit surprising. So what you said was, before, the problem was that he was neither Hermitian nor anti-Hermitian, kind of mixed.
Right.
A complex operator. But once you remove the anti-quarks, it becomes Hermitian. It becomes anti-Hermitian.
It becomes purely anti-Hermitian.
And with positive determinants. So
that's right.
Do lattice.
Yeah.
So is that an easy way to understand that?
I don't know an easy way to understand it. And you, the pattern is kind of repeated, because remember the full operator I showed you had an anti-Hermitian part and a Hermitian part. Well, this is anti-Hermitian. You can show this is Hermitian. So right away, when you start including the higher order corrections, you get back to a complicated thing. It just happens the leading term has one property alone. That it's anti-Hermitian. Right. It's not going to get you everything, but it's just going to let, if somehow you're only interested in what's happening in that little shell, mm-hmm. you can figure out what's happening in that little shell. Okay, so how would you apply this in a lattice simulation? Okay. Now, if I take the original M, the original guy, which had everything in it, including antiparticles, it's easy to show that if I turn off the background field, or actually more generally, if I just choose a background field that has some parity symmetry, then the determinant is real even at finite density. It turns out there's a nice pairing of eigenvalues. So what that means, though, is that if I am in the Fermi surface theory and I expand around A equals 0, I should get a leading term which is real and positive, and then I should get corrections which are due to this higher dimension terms, and those are suppressed by either the magnitude of the gauge field, background gauge field divided by mu, or its derivatives divided by mu. So if you want to do this on the lattice, and I guess Hong and I are in the process of wheedling lattice groups into trying to do these simulations, what you really need to do is you need to have two different lattice spacings. You need to have one which is in which you do your in which the gauge fields live, and then you need to have a finer lattice spacing, which must be at least as fine as mu inverse, because you want to account for the Fermi, the chemical potential term, but is much smaller than the gauge lattice spacing. If you have that hierarchy, then the determinant which appears in your calculations for this Fermi surface theory will be approximately real and positive, up to corrections of this size. And so that hopefully is something you can do. Hopefully you can evaluate those integrals by important sampling. And at least you should get a non-trivial check on the analytic results for asymptotic density. The hope would be that you could actually go to, you know, try to push this and go down to...
I didn't understand what the lattice with two spacings mean.
Well, effectively, you never really compute the determinant on... the calculation of the determinant is sort of separate from the realization of the gauge fields as plaquettes, right? It's just a weighting factor that appears, and so it's a subroutine in your program. So you go out, you're doing your program, and then you've got to compute this thing, and so you just go to some other discretization. That other discretization is finer. It's got to be finer because you want to include the effects of mu. However, the effects of the gauge field fluctuation should probably be of order, you know, Fermi inverse, right? So you just need mu much larger than lambda QCD and two lattices.
Okay.
And so.
Maybe you should explain why is it positive when there's some background gauge field. Anybody got Fermi on? Fermi on the terminal.
Right. So
it.
Well, in regular QCD. So let's suppose I didn't have a chemical potential. Then it just is. You can prove that it is for any background.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So what this line says is that even though you have a finite mu, if you're in a very special background like A equals zero, or there's actually a larger class which is parity invariant A's, you can prove that there's a pairing, special pairing of these complex eigenvalues, so the product turns out to be positive and real. basically what you do is you write out the eigenvalue equation, and then you use these parity operations and complex conjugation, and you can show there's a pairing between different eigenvalues, lambda and lambda. If lambda is there, then lambda star is also there. So when you take the whole product, you get something.
What's the symmetry?
It's a parity symmetry. And so A equals 0 is just a simple example where the parity symmetry applies. Well, A will eventually be a dynamical field, but this is only computed, you know, term by for every particular A, then you compute the determinant. So for the purposes of calculating the determinant, A is a background field.
Right. But then in the presence of that background field, you have parity.
So if you don't, then you will generally have a complex determinant.
But for any field with a parity, the opposite parity field must have the same weight
in action. Yeah, maybe I'm not being clear. So in the Fermi surface theory, okay, if I'm only interested in that little shell, then the leading order term in M will produce a positive real determinant. Okay, and then there are corrections beyond that.
The leading order means no gauge field in the background.
Well, no, leading order meaning that...
This is the famous sign problem.
Yeah, so leading order means that I keep this term and I throw out this term. Okay, so why should I be able to throw out this term? Well, if the derivative or the gauge fields that are acting in here are small compared to mu, then this term is suppressed.
But are you going to be on a spatial lattice while you're doing that?
I'm just going to realize, so in my subroutine in which I compute the determinant, I'm just going to compute the determinant of this.
Okay. Discretizing in momentum space?
Well, however you like. I mean, you can realize this in coordinate space if you want. So I'm probably not being very clear, but the claim, well, let me tell you what the claim is. So the claim is that if you're trying to do the Fermi surface, just the shell region near the Fermi surface, you'll get a determinant in which the leading term, because that leading operator I showed you on the last slide has nice properties, is real and positive. But now, of course, there are going to be corrections. And how big are those corrections? Are going to be down by powers of either A over mu or derivatives of A. Because this thing is a functional of A in the end. It's just you choose an A and I compute this, it's a functional of that A. So it's got to have an expansion like this. Yeah? No, I don't think so. So,
no,
I don't think it's particle hole symmetry.
It's about the symmetry. What is that? There must be some discrete symmetry that you still have left.
Is it not when, for every gauge field configuration, you have the parity inflection?
You do.
So then do the contribution combined to make a determinant?
Right, but you wouldn't want to restrict the measure of this integral to only parity invariant A's, or even parity odd A's.
But as long as your action weighs them, is the action weighted?
Right, but you're leaving out some other configurations which don't have any special, which are not eigenstates of P.
No, I'm not talking about eigenstates of P. You have A plus and A minus, they're coming pairs under parity reflection. No?
Well, you have to, in this measure, you have to include all possible A's.
Right.
And some A's will not be eigenstates of P. So they'll neither be A pluses or A minuses.
No. For one that is not an eigenstate of P, there's always, you act one with P.
Right, but these things are not linear. I mean, these, so are you saying I'll build it out of an A plus and an A minus?
Right.
And then, but these, the things which appear in the integrand are not linear, so. Okay, well, maybe we can talk about it. Okay, so I guess the only thing I want to leave you with is I think there's a way, if you're only interested in the dynamics very close to the Fermi surface, that you may actually be able to simulate that on the lattice. But keep in mind that I have in mind QCD here because the scale that's going to appear here and here is going to be order lambda QCD. So as long as I take mu much larger than lambda QCD, then I'm in good shape. In another system, so here I talk about maybe this can be used in condensed matter systems. Not sure exactly how that plays out. Okay. So I mentioned that it was rather tedious for people to show that color flavor locking was the ground state at asymptotic density, and that there's now a kind of better way of showing it. And that also is a result of positivity. So let's suppose I'm at asymptotic density, so whatever pairing that's occurring is happening close to the Fermi surface. And let's suppose that I can then approximate the dynamics with that effective theory that I described to you, in which the determinant, fermion determinant, is real and positive. Then you can use something called a Wapf-Witten inequality. And what it basically says, so the way these Wapf inequalities work is that you look at a current-current correlator, and so this is a current that creates some state with some chosen quantum numbers. And often what you can do is you can bound the two-point function of this current in an arbitrary background gauge field in terms of some parameters which appear in the propagator of the individual quark lines. And if you can bound the two-point function in a general gauge field, then averaging with a positive measure doesn't change that bound. It still leaves you with a bound. Okay? And so it's very crucial that you have a positive measure when you do your averaging, otherwise you're screwed. Okay? But in the effective theory, that little shell near the Fermi surface, we've shown there is a positive measure, so you're okay. So what you can do is you can regulate the theory by sticking in by hand the color flavor locking gap. Okay? And then you can look in channels which have, say, quantum numbers of the generators of some of those color flavor locking symmetries, and you can ask questions like, is there a Goldstone boson in this channel? If there's a Goldstone boson in this channel, then the two-point function falls off as a power law. But if there isn't a massless state in this channel, then it has to fall off exponentially. And what you can show is that in all of these channels, it falls off exponentially. So what that means is there isn't a Goldstone boson in this channel, so that particular symmetry is not broken. So in a very kind of clever, direct way, you can show that color flavor locking is the symmetries of the color flavor lock phase must be symmetries of the three flavor theory at asymptotically high density. So you don't have to go through all the bubble energy calculations that we actually went through. Did I go through that too quickly?
No, that's fine. Yeah.
Okay.
What gives us indication broken in this phase?
So the color flavor lock symmetry, one of the things that Frank noticed that I still find extremely puzzling is that the color flavor locked phase, if you look at the global symmetries, it has the exact same global symmetries as zero density QCD with three massless flavors. So for example, it has 8 Goldstone bosons.
The symmetry of the galactic phase should have some symmetry broken compared to zero.
See, this is why, yeah. So because there's no good order parameter, how can I say this? There's no actual good order parameter for differentiating the CFL phase from the zero density phase, because the symmetries are actually the same. And so that's why Frank has this hypothesis of he calls hadron continuity, that basically it could be that in that phase diagram I showed you at the beginning, there isn't actually a sharp boundary between. It turns out that the same global symmetries which are broken here are broken here in the three flavor case. And so you're hard pressed to find an order parameter which you can, you know, which is zero here and suddenly becomes non-zero here, which would be a. It's different in the sense that it's in the Higgs phase. Okay, there's a Meissner effect and the gluon.
I mean the symmetry breaking.
Well, but it's different by the realization of the gauge symmetries. But you know, in the fancy way of speaking, you can't actually break gauge symmetries. So the Higgs phase is actually continuously connected to the confining phase. So. Generally, the way you differentiate between these phases is you look at global symmetries and you say, well, the global symmetry breaking pattern is different in the two phases, so there must be a boundary. But if there's no difference in the global symmetries, then you can't necessarily say there's a phase boundary.
So are you comparing the fine density nuclear matter phase and what you label color symmetry, are those the same? Is that what you're doing?
Well,
or are you arguing about zero density?
No, I'm sorry. I should amend that, because obviously you could think of a phase transition between zero density and nuclear matter. But let's suppose I'm right here.
I mean, there's a transition in neutrino density.
Yeah. Right, right. But if I go, say, from here to here, there may not be a transition. There's no order parameter we can find. So.
This theorem is that it does not exist in order parameter. This says that no bright young person can find an order parameter.
No, I think the sim. So what you can show is that the symmetries are the same.
Oh, okay.
Because it's local.
Yeah.
You show the symmetries.
Yeah, I mean it's both SU3 cross SU3 broken to SU3. So, I mean it's realized in a very different way because in this phase they're pions, and in this phase the corresponding degrees of freedom are Higgs gluons. So it's very, very different if you look at the microphysics, but in terms of some symmetry argument, you're hard pressed to find a difference.
Right, but as the quantum Hall effect showed, as Chagan Wang has repeatedly emphasized in a series of papers, the Landau classification is everything. The quantum Hall states are not distinguishable with global symmetry.
Well, the physics is clearly different in the different phases, but the global symmetries are the same. Exact three flavors. For two flavors is very different because at two flavors you have chiral symmetry breaking here, you don't have chiral symmetry breaking here. So there's a clear phase boundary.
And nature is very tough on us with the quarks, the strange quarks.
Right. So the whole question is whether nature, and there's actually a question of whether there's there's a crystalline phase in here, which I don't really want to talk about. But there's exotic stuff which might happen here, which I haven't discussed in this talk. Okay. So let me, I guess I actually finished. I didn't think I was going to get through all that material. So let me just give my conclusion. So just in the last few years, we've had a pretty significant improvement of our understanding of the QCD phase diagram. And we've actually discovered some new phases of matter, like color flavor locking. The analytic results and the rigorous theorems are only really hold in the limit of asymptotic density, so we don't really exactly know what's happening at intermediate density. And what I tried to emphasize in this talk is that the special properties of the Fermi surface itself play an important role in obtaining these results. My statement would be that there are still strong hints that even at intermediate densities there's color superconductivity, although that's far from rigorous. And I didn't really have time to talk about the phenomenological impact of all this stuff, but let me just say there are sort of three possibilities. One is that you really actually have quark stars. That it, you know, you might have neutron stars, but you also have things called quark stars, which are, you know, smaller and denser. This depends on an assumption about whether three-flavor matter has a very odd true ground state called strange matter. Okay, and so that's sort of a separate issue. What these new results really tell us is that if you have a traditional neutron star, and it just happens that at the core of that neutron star, the maximum density exceeds whatever the density is required to start thinking about it as quark matter, then it's very likely that that core will be superconducting.
That's not a sharp boundary.
Pardon me?
That's not a sharp boundary.
Well, in the real world, it probably is, because it's only in the three. So this whole technical discussion we had about three flavors, that's only for three massless flavors. So in the real world. Well, because the strange quark mass is really quite large, so.
No, I know, but I don't understand.
So if I go back to this.
Symmetry is broken in nuclear matter of high density, which is not broken in the color symmetry.
Right. So let's suppose I had two massless quarks.
Yeah.
Okay. In that case, I have SU2 cross SU2 breaking to SU2, SU2 left cross SU2 right breaks to SU2 vector in this phase.
Do you have it at finite density?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I have it at finite density, but.
Sure.
Well. I can say very little rigorously about anything on this diagram as soon as I leave this vertical axis, because all bets are kind of off.
At any finite density, the nuclear matter, you can think of it as quark matter. I mean, there could be a first order transition with a density jump, something like that.
I'm not sure why you want to think of nuclear matter as quark matter, because I mean there is a case where I have nucleons sort of packed tightly together, but they're clearly color singlets, and there isn't a lot of color leakage between them.
I know.
And then,
always a tiny bit, right? And that's
it's not even a well-defined. There's not a well-defined definition.
Well, exactly. That's what
I'm saying. Exactly. Yeah. Because this picture of little balls.
There'll always be some exchange, right? Of course, between the nuclei close together.
No, I agree with Matthew. There's not a sharp definition.
There's no symmetry.
Well.
Yeah.
So I agree with you that there isn't a sharp distinction between nuclear matter and quark matter. So in fact, when I defined what I meant by quark matter, I had to sort of be careful. However, I would be very surprised if the symmetries, the symmetry breaking pattern that applies here doesn't also apply at fairly low densities in nuclear matter. I mean, it might not be the case. I can't prove it rigorously, but I would be surprised.
And the chiral symmetry breaking gives one of the massless
density. Well, I mean, you can do perturbative calculations where you expand in the chemical potential. So you can sort of move away from this a little bit, and you can sort of see that, okay, maybe chiral symmetries will eventually get restored and things like that at high densities. But when you estimate the critical density that it takes for that, it's quite high. It's going to be some, you know, it's you're talking about deep in the core of a neutron star before those calculations suggest anything big is happening. So, but I don't want to dispute it because, as I said, it's not, one can't really say anything rigorously. Okay. So, I mean, in a sense, if you like Frank's picture of hadron continuity, this little orange or this little green ball that I drew is sort of ill-defined, because it may just be that as you move in here, you go from a phase which has the same symmetry breaking pattern, but you know, in here you're sort of in a Higgs phase, and here you're in a confining phase.
Let's just draw a fuzzy green ball.
Yeah, fuzzy green ball. Okay. But nevertheless, the properties of this region may be very different from the outer regions, and so hopefully there's some observable consequence of that. But I think that issue is far from settled. So, thanks.
Well, as I said in my email, Steve would be happy to answer a few questions about how safe you are on the web. But maybe I should first put a couple of science questions. The last couple of days, I've been trying to work with him on some biophysics problems, but he was constantly interrupted by phone calls because by the border. So the U.S. government is really going to go ahead with this new web version of the Voice of America, and trying to set web traffic. This company is really going to take off because the CIA uses this technology. And here's some really interesting story to tell about this quote unquote friends in the CIA. So if some of you want to ask him, some of you want to come to Logan Village, some of you are coming. All welcome. You have the chance to ask about safety and what question you're thinking of doing as well. So my first perhaps couple purely scientific questions about physics. I guess Matthew, you already have that. Okay. Any science questions? Okay, then I guess you would feel free to ask. I mean, he's already told me if I had really sensitive mail, I shouldn't send it to Apple feed. Yahoo.com. So, is there no questions? So, apparently, email.
Yeah, I do, but I don't send any, I don't send secrets over email. PGP is pretty good, actually. Yeah, actually, it's kind of interesting because, you know, Microsoft has a lock on the whole email client market because Outlook is pretty much the dominant thing. And then so you might ask, why didn't they just put an encryption engine in Outlook? And I actually suspect that they probably made a deal with the NSA a while ago not to do that. And so what you'll see is that if other companies start getting traction with that, then they'll probably release theirs, and then they'll dominate the market. They'll set, because they can set the standard. The main issue is standard setting. Because if I use PGP and you use something else and I send you an email, you won't be able to read what I sent you. So we have to set that standard.
You use PGP then. No worries.
Yeah, no worries.
So it's just an issue of standard.
Yeah.
For PGP?
Pretty good privacy. It's an encryption. It's a set of encryption protocols. What is the use of?
Your software.
Oh, well,
Tribal boy.
Actually,
so he's afraid to go to China.
Well, a few years ago, with some former PhD students, and when I used to be at Yale, and so with some former students, I started a software company. And the problem that we wanted to solve has to do with encrypted communications. And the thing that we realized, this was actually there used to be export restrictions on strong encryption. And that was only lifted in, I think, 99 or 2000. But we knew that when they lifted those restrictions, then every web browser would have a full-strength encryption engine. So right now, every web browser has this thing called an SSL engine, which is a full-strength encryption engine. And despite what paranoid people would tell you, the NSA actually cannot break 128-bit symmetric key encryption. So, as far as I know. As far as academic cryptographers, who I think are not that far behind NSA cryptographers, say that we can't do it. So, our interest was, well, once you have that, you're going to have overnight a 100% install base of encryption engines on people's desktops. And so we wrote, our software is server-side code that interacts with that, the SSL engine on your browser. And so you can set up VPNs over your browser and do all kinds of things. And one of the applications of it is in China, which is actually, I guess, number two right now in the number of internet users. They're up to like 50 million internet users now. There's a very elaborate firewall which intercepts or can intercept traffic coming in and out of China, and so they control the amount of the kind of political information that can go into China from the outside, and also communication between people on the internet within China. So one of the things we thought would be used, this software could be used for, is you could actually host servers outside of China, but then people could connect to them from their desktop in China, and once they have that connection, then the government can't tell what they're doing. And so what Tony referenced is that there's this long-standing government agency called Voice of America, which is mainly dealing with radio technology, and their goal is to get U.S. propaganda into other countries over the radio. And so now they're turning their attention to the internet, and of course they'd like to have a similar capability over the internet. And so there's a bill that just got introduced a few weeks ago into Congress to create something called the Office of Global Internet Freedom, and that and. Now the reason I'm more interested in the internet project is because the internet is actually interactive. So I'm not that interested about in the U.S. broadcasting junk into other people's countries. Although I think in the Cold War, I think that actually was useful stuff. But
I think it was useful.
Yeah, but and probably there are some Eastern Europeans here who know a lot more about it than I do. But in China, the issue is if you enable these 50 million, and it doubles every year actually. So you're talking about 100 million in next year and. If you enable them to communicate with each other in a way that the government can't listen in, then you know, you're talking about creating essentially a free press, freedom of information, freedom of organization, and so you'll sort of accelerate the democratization of the country. So that's kind of what we were interested in. And so, but you know, doing anything with the federal government seems to take years and years, and it just, you know, you never know what's going to happen. It's like a big elephant. So, so I can't tell you how the story is going to end, but it's something that we work on. No, they already have the browser. So actually, by just giving them an IP address, which lets them connect into our network.
But it's easy enough for China to block that.
Right. So there's a whole second layer of technologies that we developed, which are peer-to-peer technologies. So there are little clients that you can install on your computer here, and then that would make your computer an access point for people in China that into the network. So eventually, what you want to force them into is they either have to block out the entire net outside of China, or they have to let their people have access. And so, yeah, like that stuff.
And you said the same things happened in Iran.
Yeah, so when we were running, like if you look in our server logs, you can see the huge numbers of connections from Saudi Arabia and Iran, and China is the number one.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Okay, well, thanks for speaking.